Welcome to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. This is a show for deal makers in the blockchain business, where we meet the players who are changing the game today and get their insight into everything from the red tape to the raise. This is your host, Colton Moffitt. Let's get started. Hey everybody, we're here today with Darren Marble. He's the CEO of Issuance, and that's a modern marketing platform for digital securities. And the Issuance platform connects, engages, and matches digital securities issuers with authenticated, interested investors. He's also the CEO of CrowdfundX, a fintech marketing firm that markets Regulation A+ IPOs and digital securities offerings. Darren, it's great to have you here with us today.
Thanks, Colton. It's a real pleasure. Appreciate you having me on.
Awesome. Would you just go ahead and tell us in your own words a little bit about your past ventures and how you got into the blockchain business?
Yeah, it was a long and windy road. So, I'm actually a college dropout and I got into sales. It was one of the things you can get into without having a college degree. Ultimately got into enterprise software sales. Spent 10 years selling Oracle database and applications to Fortune 500 companies. In the midst of that career, I started a business that over 7 or 8 years evolved into what it is today. The common denominator, the thing we were always good at, was digital marketing. And we started by marketing Kickstarter and Indiegogo campaigns. This was at a time when rewards crowdfunding was actually a phenomenon. It was unique. It was a hot thing. And, you know, we ended up marketing 80 or 90 Kickstarter campaigns over a few years. And then that put us into a position to transition into market Regulation A+, also known as Reg A+ campaigns. We've now marketed half the Reg A+ IPOs in the US. And then even more recently, December, January, about 9 months ago, we started marketing digital securities offerings, also known as security token offerings. And, the theme there was just, we had all this experience marketing compliant IPOs, and we had partnered with investment banks and underwriters. And, we saw that there was really a need to help digital securities issuers market their deals to the right investors. And, then started Issuance really in the past few months. So it's been an interesting journey to get to this point.
Well, that's definitely quite a process, but I can see how that story developed, and it makes a lot of sense coming from those early type of Kickstarter projects that move now into really the fascinating field that you're in. And I'm also somebody who chose an alternative education path after a couple of years doing the more traditional college experience, and sales is definitely one of those things where it's like, hey, you want to go and make some money, and here you are having chosen to not do it the traditional way. So you really find out quickly if you're going to do well or not. So how did Issuance take form in these past few months, as you mentioned, and where are you taking it now? I mean, we want to talk about some of your partnerships today. You've got a new client announcement.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that.
So, I'm a co-founder and owner of a few businesses. And for a long time, my primary business was CrowdfundX. And we gave ourselves that name when we were marketing these Kickstarter campaigns, and it kind of stuck with us. But under the CrowdfundX umbrella, we signed deals with Kodak One, which is developing an image rights management platform on the blockchain designed to help photographers track their IP, get compensated for their work, et cetera. And then we also signed a deal with T0. Which is developing a secondary exchange, a trading platform for security tokens. And it was really through those two engagements that I got a feel for the industry. And what I noticed is that, in terms of digital securities or, again, security tokens, everyone was kind of building either a security token platform or a secondary trading platform. Yet there's a huge gap in the middle between those sides of the industry. And that gap is deal marketing and capital raising. And at the end of the day, what issuers in this space really want is to raise capital. And, you know, so they get routed to Polymath or Securitize, or they hear about Harbor, they have a phone call there, they come up with a strategy for tokenization, but ultimately those platforms do not market deals. They do not do anything, regarding distribution. And that's the role we've always played. We've always been an investor marketing firm and connector between issuers and investors. And so I saw this gap and I thought, you know what, that's going to be the biggest pain point. It's not going to be tokenization, although that's a prerequisite. And I don't think it's going to be liquidity, although everyone wants liquidity. Really, in order to get liquidity, you actually have to go sell something first. And so the vision for Issuance is to be the leading platform that connects digital securities issuers to interested investors. And we are in the process of developing this platform. In the interim, as we're developing it, we're actively signing contracts with issuers and providing more traditional marketing services, advisory work, facilitating introductions between the issuer and crypto hedge funds, and now increasingly, you know, funds all over the world, because we have trusted relationships with these funds. We built these relationships in the Kodak and T0 deals, but ultimately Issuance is a tech company. We're developing a tech platform, and I see us as the liaison between tokenization and liquidity.
Gotcha. So in a way, doing the development is guided by the activity that you're having to do manually, and that way you're ending up with a platform that is definitely answering the needs of what people want, rather than trying to dream it all up beforehand and then force it onto the market.
That's correct. And here's another observation, you know, for people to consider is, if you look at a tokenization platform, and let's use Polymath as an example. Polymath is a technology company, right? They have a protocol. And now you look at, let's say, a secondary trading platform like T0, also a technology company, lots of engineers and developers. And yet, deal marketing and capital raising are supposed to be people-driven, broker-dealer-driven. I don't buy that. And so I think that's where the opportunity is. The opportunity is to automate the role of the broker-dealer. And I don't have anything against broker-dealers. In fact, I've learned a lot about capital markets from really successful owners of broker-dealers and investment banks that have partnered with me or my firm and even taken us under their wing. But if you look at the way a broker-dealer operates, for the most part, they put a lot of energy into getting one deal out at a time because it is a manual, massively inefficient process. They will set up roadshows where half the attendees are there for free food and booze, and the issuer doesn't really know who, you know, where the real money is, because half the people there are plate lickers, for better or worse. and I don't think that it's going to totally disappear. I think there's always a need for some human interaction, but as much as we can, we want to automate that process. If tokenization is tech-driven, liquidity is tech-driven, you know, I believe that capital raising should be tech-driven. And our goal is to make that process faster, easier, and more efficient. And that's precisely what we're doing.
That makes sense. And that way, the parts that are actually human can be much more authentic and a lot less BS. And you can leave all of the conversation and the communication interaction up until that point where you need the human interaction can just be smooth, simple, pain-free. I like that. So would you tell us a little bit about the recently announced partnership with Securitize and how that's going to impact both of your clients? Because that's what really caught my eye with what you're talking about lately, and it really fit in with some of the stuff you've been posting on LinkedIn.
Absolutely. So Securitize is a leading tokenization platform. And what's really interesting about them is, you know, this is a very focused team, and they're very selective about the issuers they're taking on as clients. Almost all of their issuers are Series B companies, companies that have raised seed rounds, angel rounds, Series A. They're operating businesses. They have revenue, millions, tens of millions in revenue. And to me, that's incredible. And I think, you know, because I've built a business like that, and it took a number of years. It's not easy to suddenly find yourself at the top of the food chain in a new nascent emerging industry. And yet they've done that fairly quickly. And you know, what Securitize's clients want, again, is they want to go out and raise capital. Securitize has a necessary component with their tokenization platform. And really the objective of the partnership is for Securitize to be able to flow deals over to issuance that we can then partner with those issuers and help them market their deals and get them in front of likely investors. And conversely, we are on the receiving end of a tremendous amount of deal flow every day, every week. And a handful of the inquiries that we receive are looking for tokenization. And that allows us to pass over those deals to Securitize. So it's kind of a fluid partnership. You know, I've met Jamie Finn, their president, a few times. We were on a panel together talking about digital securities with Juan Hernandez, the founder and CEO of Open Finance Network in Chicago. And I'll tell you what I really love about this industry and digital securities in particular is that the people I've met so far, these are all really good people. Like, these are good guys, good girls, smart people, have their heads on straight. Like, they're passionate, they're focused. They're people you could be friends with, you know, like take them home to your mom. And unfortunately, I think that's been missing in the ICO market. And that's evident with all the scams that you still hear about every week. You know, Wall Street Journal reported earlier this year that at least $1 billion of the $6 billion raised globally last year in 2017 went into a highly questionable deal that showed signs of fraud. And it's just really reassuring and gives me a lot of hope and optimism that the future is bright. And that's evidenced by the people that are leading these businesses that are pioneering this industry with us and in partnership with us. These are really good people, and the Securitize guys fit the bill.
Okay. Now that's very interesting. And, you know, one of the questions I wanted to talk to you about, you've touched on a little bit, which is that classification as a digital security offering versus what some people would call a securities token offering, or the unregulated, you know, big global cousin, the ICO. So would you tell us a little bit about the nuances as you see them there and expand on that point you just made?
Sure. So a digital security, also known as a security token, is a digital asset that is compliant with federal securities laws and run on the blockchain. You know, so there's a trustless aspect to it. And what that means is that it's a security. And so, you know, we think of digital securities as Pomp would say, Anthony Pompliano, who's also a huge advocate. This is an evolutionary change. It's not necessarily revolutionary. It's still a security, but it's digital. It's more efficient than a share of stock. And it will open up the opportunity for illiquid assets to become tokenized and then made liquid by listing those digital assets or tokens on a regulated secondary exchange or trading platform. So there's this, you know, value prop around digital securities that's driven by liquidity, the same way you have ICOs, utility tokens driven by liquidity as well. The difference being that these are compliant with securities laws. And, you know, I don't think this is a movement that's exclusive to the United States. You know, Binance has announced a partnership with the government of Malta to launch a security token exchange in Malta. I've got a few colleagues that are there right now, and that's really exciting. And, you know, I'm seeing in real time, and I'm feeling it every day, there's just a shift happening globally. Funds that previously only invested in ICOs are now dipping their toes in the water and looking at digital securities. And to me, that's a very positive sign. And so, you know, you've got these other indicators like the parent company of the New York Stock Exchange, ICE, announced Bakkt, which is a digital assets trading platform they've been developing in partnership with Microsoft. NASDAQ has hinted at launching a regulated crypto exchange earlier this year, per their CEO, Adina Friedman, in a CNBC interview. So those are kind of like local domestic signs that this is going to be a mega trend. But internationally, we're seeing things too. Binance in Malta, ICO funds. I mean, I talked to an ICO fund in Hong Kong, and these guys were like, we believe that digital securities are the future. And I said, how many digital securities deals have you invested in? And they said, well, none yet. You know, maybe you're the first. And that was just incredible, like to hear guys that have had success in ICOs and trading out of cryptocurrencies, that now the thesis, and these guys are in Hong Kong, right? And they're somehow, they found us and they're interested in deals like issuance and others. I think it's just incredible. So that's kind of, you know, what is a digital security? And, you know, I'm bullish. I think, you know, people complain a lot about SEC regulations, but the truth is that they don't really appreciate where we've come and where we've come from and kind of what the opportunities are. What I mean by that is issuers have a number of pathways to raise capital legally. They can use the Reg D exemption where they can raise an unlimited amount of capital and generally solicit or market their deal, and they're restricted to verified accredited investors. That's a securities exemption from registration. You don't have to register your deal with the SEC. You have Reg A Plus, which we've run a lot of those campaigns. There is a registration. It's essentially a mini IPO, but it gives the issuer the ability to raise capital from anyone over 18 globally. Retail investors, you don't have to be accredited and you can market the deal. You've got regulation crowdfunding, also known as Reg CF, where you can also market the deal, raise up to $1 million, and anyone over 18 can invest. So to me, you know, these exemptions are new. They didn't exist, you know, 3-4 years ago. They were part of the Jobs Act that was passed by President Obama in 2012. And I think they're great. You know, if you want to go out and try to raise $100 million, you can do a Reg D. It's fast, easy, and efficient. If you have an established business and you've got customers and fans and you want those customers and fans to invest in your deal, go out and do a Reg A. Don't have a huge budget, but you want to allow non-accredited to invest, go do a Reg CF. It'll cost you 10 grand. So to me, there's plenty of viable pathways, and that's also exciting and, again, gives me hope for the growth of this industry.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a sort of perfect storm of regulation that has actually made it simpler than probably what most people have in mind. You know, when we hear things like SEC regulated, we picture, you know, the worst parts of our favorite movies about Hollywood. You know, we picture this just sort of terrible thing where a guy's never going to be able to get ahead and he's just going to make some little error just trying to raise money for his business, and then there's going to be guys in FBI windbreakers everywhere, you know. So
right.
And I think that's kind of, it's coming from a place of just innocent ignorance, maybe, in the most part. So it's really interesting to hear you describe those different pathways someone could take. And as you have these jurisdictions like Malta coming out with what they're hoping to be pretty progressive and helpful, efficient regulation for this space, and it's actually apparently not so bad in the United States, what do you see in terms of the next few years, how it's going to play out with capital flowing from different kinds of players to those regulated token offerings you're describing versus jurisdictions that are maybe more attractive to the Wild West unregulated ICO crowd?
Yeah, look, that's a great question. And I hear all the time people talk about, and I read in articles, you know, crypto-friendly jurisdictions. It's in Switzerland, it's in Singapore, it's in Malta. And that's great. But I don't believe the next great entrepreneur that everybody knows, like the next Richard Branson or Elon Musk, is going to be doing an ICO out of Malta. I just don't believe that's going to be the case. Now, admittedly, there are people that are frustrated, and there are some very powerful and successful people that are frustrated with the SEC and subpoenas that they've been issued, in some cases more than one subpoena. So, you know, Tim Draper, who's a big venture capitalist, I think he's not investing in U.S. companies right now. Michael Arrington has received 2 subpoenas from the SEC, you know, in his fund, and you know, looking into deals they were involved in earlier this year and, you know, 2017. And he said he's not going to invest in companies in the U.S. And honestly, I think those are kind of exceptions and outliers. And I don't think there's an exodus of investors. I don't think there's an exodus of brilliant entrepreneurs taking one-way plane flights out from Los Angeles or New York or somewhere else in this country and going to Malta and disappearing forever. Are there a handful of people? Of course, there's always going to be exceptions. But I don't think it's a trend. And so I think that gets overblown and overstated. And ultimately, over time, I think you're going to see the U.S. does what it does best, which is overcome the odds, persevere, and you're going to see billions of dollars of capital flow into incredible companies, incredible entrepreneurs. You're going to see institutional investors come into the space. They're already doing so. And now with BACT and NASDAQ getting into the arena, that's another easy way for institutions to come in. They're going to start buying one-day Bitcoin futures and trading those derivatives. And then those exchanges will list Bitcoin and Ethereum and then kind of roll it out the same way Coinbase did. And ultimately, they're going to go back into listing and trading digital securities. And so I'm optimistic. I think over time, the U.S. will be the dominant player globally. And I think right now it's a little murky for some people. And certainly there's a temptation to do a deal outside the U.S. because of a quote crypto friendly jurisdiction. I think it's a moment in time and I think it will come to pass.
Right. Okay. So, you know, someone goes and does that and they put their eggs in that basket and then they might actually have a difficult time participating in the growth that's happening in the more regulated side of things, say in the U.S. or similar. Okay. That's, in that regard then, you know, what do you see as being some of the short-term obstacles to get to the point that you're describing, and maybe tell a little bit more about the long-term benefits of that regulation?
Well, I think the short-term obstacles, and this is something that I'm, you know, very transparent with, like we had a company come in from Los Angeles yesterday to our offices, got an interesting startup, and they're kind of on the fence. You know, should they run it as a digital securities offering in the U.S. and use, let's say, the Reg D exemption, raised from only accredited investors, or should they do an ICO outside the U.S.? And they had been to France and talked to all these marketing and advisory groups. And I kind of told them, I said, look, you know, here's the truth. You're going to have an easier time raising capital if you do it outside the U.S. Because in the U.S., if you do this as a digital securities offering, these are the hurdles and these are the short-term obstacles you asked about. The digital securities offerings are taking months to fund. I don't know of anybody who's running a digital security token offering raising $10 million in a month. It hasn't happened. T0 spent 7 months to run their deal. Kodak One has been out for 8 or 9 months. The deals are taking many months to fund. And I think one of the reasons for that is there's not a standard term sheet. There's not a standard deal that's being presented to investors in this space. Whereas at least with an ICO, there's a model, right, that's kind of emerged and there's these very steep discounts and the first money in comes in at a 90%, then an 80%, and so on. And with a digital securities offering, there's actually, I think, confusion on the part of the issuer and as well as the attorneys that are getting pulled in to help structure these deals. There's confusion as to like what should they sell? Should they sell security tokens? And those tokens have what economic interest in the underlying asset? Should those tokens have a right to equity? Is it a rev share? Is it a profit share? Is it discretionary? Is it a royalty? Are there tokenomics? And ultimately, everyone's got a different term sheet. And I think that's one of the issues. And so, you know, imagine a crypto hedge fund that, let's say, sees 10 deals a day, and all 10 deals have a totally different term sheet. I think that confuses the investor and it probably slows down the deal for the average issuer. So that's an issue. And to me, that's kind of a short-term obstacle until there's a standard deal. And honestly, people may or may not want to hear this, but I think they're going to have to sell equity, you know, basically going back to basics to start getting interest and funding from crypto hedge funds or more traditional investors. And look, if you're a $50 million a year business and you're growing 15% year over year, go out and do a rev share token. Great. You're a good candidate. But if you are a non-revenue generating startup and you are attempting to sell a rev share token, I think that's a joke. And I don't think those deals are going to work. I think issuers are in the process of finding out those deals won't work, and they're going to have to be more realistic and get out of fantasy land and get their head on straight and sell equity in the business if they want to get the deal done. So that's kind of my quick thought on some of the short-term issues with the landscape of digital securities here in the U.S.
Okay. That's definitely an interesting angle. You know, the concept of the fundamentals needing to be there, you know, that the business would need to have revenue, ideally be profitable, that investors are going to want an actual piece of the action, that they're going to want equity. And that when you get away from that kind of quick $10 million and subject to all the volatility that happens once people just start speculating on it and then your project's dead in 6 months, you're moving away from that to people are wanting to invest in something that is going to be there in 5 years, making them more.
Right.
Money. Yeah. Okay. That's definitely something to chew on. So in that same line of thinking, you know, what's the number one piece of advice that you would give somebody if they're considering investing in a token offering?
Well, you know, the number one piece of advice is if you're going to invest in a token offering, be prepared to lose 100% of your investment. This industry is fraught with risk. And I don't care if that's a digital security or an ICO, I don't think it matters. I think there are a lot of highly questionable deals on both sides of the fence. And as much as I'm pro-regulation and pro-digital securities, I'm keenly aware that regulated markets don't prevent scams. Bernie Madoff operated and scammed billions of dollars from a lot of really smart people in a highly regulated market. People run Ponzi schemes in regulated markets, pump and dumps in regulated markets. So, you know, I'm aware of that. I would just caution investors that, you know, if you're going to put in money, you know, this should be in your I can afford to lose it bucket, because these deals are risky. And this is an emerging industry. It's extremely volatile. You know, if you look at the prices of Bitcoin and Ethereum in the last 10 months, people have made and lost fortunes. And I just think people need to be extra, extra cautious and, you know, not necessarily believe the hype. And, you know, if you are going to invest, do your homework. Look at the team. I mean, this is a simple strategy and it's time tested. That's probably where you're going to learn the most about, you know, how risky the deal was. Who are the entrepreneurs? What's their track record? And even then it's tricky. I mean, you know, who knew Mark Zuckerberg was going to be one of the richest people in the world back when he was like, what, 18, 19, and, you know, Peter Thiel is taking a risk on him and Sean Parker is taking a risk, you know, 500K, a few million bucks. You know, what was his track record? You know, a college dropout. So who knows? This is a very risky game, investing in startups. And therefore, maybe investors should look at putting money into bigger deals, later stage companies. Right? It's much safer to go out and buy shares of Apple than it is to put money into a startup. Now, if you put money into Apple, you're not going to make 10x. Maybe you make 2x or 3x over several years. If you hold on to it for 10, 15 years, maybe you can make a lot of money, but you got to wait. So there's kind of like a risk reward profile, obviously. And, you know, I'm seeing more later stage companies, even enterprise companies, even publicly traded companies here in the US that are now planning digital securities offerings. To me, that's where I would be looking as an investor, instead of the super early stage deals where, you know, there's very little traction, or, you know, the team is a question mark. But I would always start with the team. And also, I think it helps to find people who have made investments in companies before and kind of look at their opinions. And I'm not saying to only invest when, you know, there's a syndicate or there's a lead in the deal, but that can help too. You know, if you see a crypto hedge fund in the deal, that might indicate that this is an interesting company or potentially lower risk, doesn't guarantee it. So, you know, associating with people who have had success investing, I think is one way you can mitigate risk as an investor, but be willing to lose it because there's just no guarantees.
Sure. So if they identify some hedge funds that are in that space and they go ahead and decide to try to follow some of that activity, they can at least cash in a little bit on all of the expense that was paid in the legal review and the due diligence and save themselves some of that time and headache, but still not put more than they can afford to lose, of course. Because even going to your example, it's not like Peter Thiel or Sean Parker put anything into Facebook that they couldn't have just gone to sleep and forgotten about, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. So I think it's a good signal.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Good advice. I appreciate you sharing that. I want to talk about two more things before I let you go. First would be, what kind of partnerships do you see being most valuable for you and issuance in the near future?
Well, I think, you know, the two partnerships we've announced so far have been the most strategic. We announced that we had executed a listing agreement with Open Finance Network where our own digital securities will trade. We announced a partnership with Securitize where we're flowing deal from one company to the other. And I think the next partnerships we're announcing will, you know, fall in line with those two. So we're very close to other strategic tokenization platforms as well as secondary trading platforms. And as much as we can, you know, we are non-exclusive. I've had success, you know, in other businesses and over the years, play nice with everyone. And if we can play nice with everyone here, I think that's to our advantage. And that may mean we partner with multiple tokenization platforms that potentially compete with each other, but would have a strategic interest in working with us. And on the other side, working with multiple secondary trading platforms that, again, potentially are competitors, but, you know, would benefit if they could send their clients over to issuance so we can help them market their deals and effectively raise capital. So, you know, those are kind of the partnerships we're currently looking at. We have a few that are in the works that are highly strategic. You know, just grinding away. I think, again, there's a lot of really good people in this industry. You know, a lot of these companies are open-minded. I think partnering is a strategy that is working, not just for us, but for others. And I imagine, as in any, you know, competitive market, over time, you know, the partnerships become a little harder to execute. Companies grow, some, you know, fall by the wayside and fold, and it becomes more competitive and fierce and cutthroat. I think that will happen, but right now, you know, a lot of these companies are open-minded, they're opportunistic, and kind of willing to talk to anyone in a sense, you know, if there's some advantage they can get. And so that's the moment we're in right now.
Okay. Appreciate that feedback. How about your favorite deal story? So whether that was just like an interesting negotiation, you know, maybe it was one of those things that fell into your lap and it was really awesome how it worked out, or one where it almost completely fell apart and you were able to pull it through at the last minute. Tell us your favorite deal story.
Yeah. So I'll tell you something I learned as an entrepreneur, and this is one of the most important lessons I've ever learned. And I would encourage other entrepreneurs to hear this and figure out how they can apply this story to their business. When we first started marketing Kickstarter campaigns, which was like 7 years ago, 6 years ago, we were selling services at $2,500 a month. And the company would hire us, let's say they wanted to raise 50 grand, and we'd say, okay, you pay us 2,500 a month, we'll give you an account manager and a social media marketing person. And we'd send over these contracts for 5 grand, 2 months of work, and we were getting pushback. You know, people were negotiating with us. They were saying, guys, if I had 5 grand, I wouldn't be doing a Kickstarter campaign. Or, hey, Darren, can I pay you $1,000 now and $4,000 in 2 months if we raise the money? And those were just painful conversations. Of course, nobody was living off of $5,000 in 2 months. I was working my day job. My business partner at the time, you know, he had an apartment his parents were paying for, and it was just brutal. And so, yeah, we had managed to sell a couple deals, for $5,000 a month. We've done it. We're pushing hard, you know, trying to make the business work. So finally, we're in this meeting with an entrepreneur who was a, you know, sold some company overseas in Europe. He came to the US. He wanted to do a Kickstarter campaign for a science fiction series he had dreamed up. He had no connections in Hollywood. He had no script. He had nothing. And yet he was a successful guy, and somehow he got routed to us. And we were in his office, and it was kind of a nice furnished office in Century City, Avenue of the Stars. And I'll tell you, I was ready to quit, right? Because I was like, I can't live off of the money we're making. It's embarrassing. I'm tired of people pushing back. And so we were going through our pitch, and I thought to myself, I'm done. I want to just get out of here. And I thought, maybe I'll throw out some stupid number to end this meeting early. And I said, hey, listen, dude, I'm going to cut you off. It's going to be $50,000. And he goes, $50,000 for what? I said, for us to run your deal. There's so much work we've got to do. We got to hire people. We've got to do your video. We've got to do PR, all this work. And it's going to be a huge undertaking. And he goes, all right, let's do it. I'll pay you right now. And unbelievably, we closed our largest deal ever for $50,000 on the spot. And that was 10 times larger than any deal we had signed in the past year. And so that was a breakthrough. And the lesson it taught me was this: companies on average should not undersell themselves. It's a mistake to give away value, to give away your time, your mind share, your services at you know, at a low cost or at dirt cost. Price to win, price the deal high. And when you price your deal high, it does a couple things. One, it actually creates demand, because you, believe it or not, you create the perception that you're this high-end company. Who would charge $50,000 to run a Kickstarter campaign? I threw that out there, and this guy suddenly perceived we were like the highest end marketing company in LA. But it does something else too. With $50,000, we could hire quality people. I could hire a real team instead of the part-time account managers who were basically couch surfing because we weren't paying them any money. So we could hire real quality people that had worked at agencies, media buyers, PR people. And what did that do? It increased our opportunity to deliver success. So that's a win for us because we got paid. We hired a real team. They got paid. And the client wins because we deliver a successful campaign. So that was one of the biggest breakthroughs for me and our company. And we went on to sell deals for $100,000. We went on to sell deals for $250,000. And we went on to sell deals for $500,000 cash. Companies have paid us $500,000 cash to help them market the deal or raise capital. And I'm gunning for that $1 million deal. And I'll tell you something, it's out there and I'm going to get it.
That's incredible. I really, I like that story. I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to this one before I publish it. Thank you for sharing.
Thanks, Colton.
I think that anybody listening to this, of course, is going to be able to take that and look at what they're doing and ask themselves, are we doing that right? Are we actually pricing to win? Are we charging enough to deliver what we say we can deliver? And sometimes if we don't properly value what we're doing, we end up giving less than we could have, less than we wanted to, and it's a negative feedback loop that drives you out of business. So incredible.
Exactly right. And it's like this poverty mentality. And I'm telling you, it's addicting. You just get in this mode of complete desperation, and you feel you've got to give it away to get the deal. You've got to discount. And it's extremely counterintuitive. But if you can actually overcome that block, because I'll tell you, it's a mental block is what it is. You know, you don't think you can actually sell a deal for X amount or 5 times more or 10 times more. But for people that are listening, try. I promise you, you can do it. You have nothing to lose. If you've been grinding it out there for months or years, giving away your services or your talent or your skill, you have nothing to lose in your next negotiation by bumping the price and see what happens. And I'm telling you, people are going to be blown away. They're going to be pleasantly surprised. They're going to sell more deals, create more demand, and they're going to build their businesses.
That's great. Thank you. You know, just, I want to make sure that the people who are listening and they're going to go and apply that and they realize, okay, Darren can help me out. how do they get in contact with you? How do they learn more about what Issuance can help them achieve? What's the best way to do that? And what are you working on that they can potentially check out in the next few months here?
So our website is issuance.com. We are actively raising capital in our own deal, using our own team, our own services to market the investment opportunity. It's been going great. If there's any investors, happy to go sell you on our deal, why you should be an investor in Issuance. CrowdfundX is my other firm, crowdfundx.io. We are in the process, Issuance is in the process of acquiring CrowdfundX, so we're kind of consolidating skill sets and teams and financials. And, you know, I'm on LinkedIn, so follow me on LinkedIn and let's chat. Would love to engage with you in a dialogue about the future of capital markets and digital securities. Thanks for listening.
Absolutely. Thank you. Darren Marble, everybody, issuance.com.
Thanks, Colton.
Thank you for listening to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. If you learned something today and you want to know more, go check out penduluminsight.com.